This is Wading Deep, a podcast that explores the connection between environmental justice and race.
Racism pollutes our people and land. Resilience, our strength of spirit and hand. Resurrection, our healing, made whole we stand.
I'm your host, the Reverend Jamon Taylor, rector at St. Ambrose Episcopal Church, Raleigh, North Carolina, a congregation with a long history of challenging environmental racism. I am honored to welcome for a second time, this is our second segment, our guest, Derek Beasley, multidisciplinary artist, cultural organizer, public servant. Welcome back, Derek.
Hey. Thanks for having me back.
Hey, always good. It's been so long. One of the things we left off or finished with the first segment, you were talking about your artwork in Walnut Creek, and just wanted to invite you to share more about your art, Walnut Creek, and then we could maybe talk about some artists who've impacted you, had an imprint on you as an artist.
Yeah. Where would we start? You want to talk about the Walnut Creek a little bit first?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So, I saw our RFP a little ways back from the Walnut Creek Wetland Center and saying that they had a GSI project, which is a green stormwater infrastructure. And essentially they built this this human-made wetland, so to speak, where this gravel wetland is what it's called, where essentially they're planting all these native species, and they've got these different layers of soil and gravel to catch stormwater and then feed it back into the Walnut Creek wetland, which I think is really an example of how the way that we can use technology to try to heal some of the damage that we've done to our wetlands, particularly in this neighborhood where the pollution of this with Walnut Creek has disproportionately impacted Black folks, rural folks. Even if you think about the history of the city of Raleigh dumping this water into Walnut Creek, this wastewater and how it, and so now we're going about the process of healing this creek, and cleaning this creek, and this GSI project is a part of that. And so the RFP was to create a, what they're calling an educational display, telling the story of what this GSI project, like telling the technical story of what this GSI project does, which my sculpture will do, as well as tell a little bit of the human story of what has been done in this neighborhood in regards to the Walnut Creek wetland, and particularly highlighting Black folks in their relationship to the wetland, and highlighting what it means to be healing, to use restoration of this wetland as a healing process for community. And so, like I said before, I'm building a monolith, which I'm using as a stand-in for this almost otherworldly change catalyst in the wetland, that will also be something that evolves over time, something that weathers and will continue to look more and more like this artifact, almost as if another entity put it there. But the reality is that we built all of this, and we can build so much when we're in relationship with nature, and so much is possible. And so that's, I think, the underlying message of, that is the message of this sculpture that I'm endeavoring to build this fall in Southeast Raleigh.
That's powerful, this partnership with nature and humanity, particularly Black people. And you talked about the importance of possibility in your artwork. I know when you think about wetlands, it's often overlooked. Sometimes people call it a swamp. And really the wetland is the kidney system for the Neuse River Basin. And if the Walnut Creek wetland is devastated, which it has been in the past, and basically going through kidney failure, that does not bode well for the rest of the basin, which flows all the way down to the Atlantic Ocean, you know, hundreds of miles. And so, you know, how we treat the wetland impacts not only the local community, but in communities downstream. And you talked about also this healing component. And one of the things we're doing with the Healing Pod is it's an enactment of a vision that I had when I came to St. Ambrose almost 10 years ago. A gentleman named Dr. Norman Camp, now his name is on the Walnut Creek Wetland Educational Center, his name and his wife's name, walked me around St. Ambrose, and we did the Greenway and went up to the Education Center. He told me about the history of sewage being dumped for 80 years and trash being dumped and then the area being zoned for Black people. Yeah. And through that conversation, I had this vision of basically being four stages. There was a stage when there was pristine environment. This is before European engagement. Then you have the European engagement component, which is the devastation of the wetlands, the dumping of sewers, the dumping of trash. Then a third phase is this area being zoned for Black people to live. And then Black people really restoring the wetland by partnering with government and other nonprofits. And then the fourth stage, which we're now entering, is the wetland and nature being used for the emotional and mental healing of the Black community. And so your artwork, or as you describe your work about this partnership, this good relationship between humanity and nature, reminded me of the Healing Pod, which is what we're talking about now. I'm curious to hear, who are the artists who influenced you?
There's so many, and as we've been talking, I've just kind of tried to write down a few of the folks, but there's really so many. I'd love to talk about local folks first, folks in my area, rather than not necessarily local artists, but they're folks that live in my locale. Monday Marshall, a great friend of mine, Marcella Kamara, another friend of mine, Stephen Hayes, whom I've known since middle school, and really I usually credit for getting me into creating sculpture. Another sculpture artist that I look up to and admire. Alexis Pauline Gums is an author and writer, and who lives in the area as well. But then there's other photographers that I really love: Jamel Shabazz, Gordon Parks, of course, and then sculpturally and other mediums, I love Theaster Gates and Rashid Johnson and Wangechi Mutu. Robin Kimmerer is an author that really shifted my ideas around being in relationship with the environment. Octavia Butler, Nnedi Okorafor. And let's see, let me look over here at my bookshelf and see who else I got over here. There's so many folks, but those are folks that stand out. They really impacted my creative practice, and continue to impact my creative practice and thinking about possibilities and what that looks like to express those possibilities artistically.
No, that's powerful. One of the things that this conversation is helping me realize when I think about Black artists who impact me, particularly painters and sculptures, it's this intersection with the environment, which prior to this conversation, I don't think I had that much awareness. So think about Romare Bearden, great Cubist, who was baptized in the Black Episcopal Church in Charlotte, St. Michael and All Angels. One of the tragedies of that church is that where the Carolina Panthers Stadium now sits, the Bank of America Stadium, is the 50-yard line is where that church used to sit and where Romare Bearden was baptized. And the little quote-unquote consolation prize is that they named the small park near Bank of America Stadium the Romare Bearden Park. But I think about his use of nature. I think of,
wow, you know, I did not know that. That's incredible.
It's fascinating. It is incredible. It is absolutely incredible.
I think,
yeah, unbelievable. I think about Jacob Lawrence and his use of particularly blues. I think about Jonathan Green, you know, one of my favorites, you know, down in South Carolina, and his use of nature. And then I think about, you know, Kara Walker. When I was in New York, Kara had this fantastic sculpture, The Sugar Baby. And yeah, I think it stood some 50 or 60 feet tall, carved or sculpted out of sugar. And then she was using nature, obviously the sugar from the sugar cane, but bringing awareness to, you know, the history of sugar, slavery, that connection to New York, New York processing sugar, taking the cane from Cuba and the southern part of the United States. And then that was what was used to tea. So even the New Yorks would, slavery was illegal in, you know, 1860, but using to drive it. And so that type of awareness of this intersection between nature and the artist is so important, at least in the Black artists that I just mentioned, and who are, you know, some of my favorite Black artists.
Yeah. And by no means is the list that I gave you exhaustive.
I
realized I didn't even think about musical artists.
Right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I didn't think about musical artists, John and Alice Coltrane, Christian Scott. Honestly, I won't even, I'll just stop there because there's so many Pharoah Sanders, so many that also inform my sense of like possibilities through art. Transformative capacity of darkness even, or perceived, you know, dark things. And, I was going to say, even as we're listing all of these people, it's interesting how one can grow up and not realize that, you know, this is part of our tradition as Black folks, right? Like it's not, you know, we've been meditating on these ideas, but we just don't learn about it. And so it's been really a privilege to be able to be in community with folks and be in conversation with folks like you, who, you know, where we can dialogue about these folks and then also try to make space for young people to get the similar exposure to be able to know this rich tradition that we've been a part of. Working through art to talk about possibilities, and but then particularly possibilities in terms of the environment. So it's been a beautiful journey to learn just how rich, you know, the tradition is within our community.
Yeah, as you were talking about music, which you're right, we hadn't touched on, and you mentioned those two, well, a great North Carolinian, John Coltrane. I think about another great North Carolinian, Thelonious Monk. As an aside, I had the privilege of knowing Thelonious Monk's niece, who was a member of St. Ambrose, Ms. Almeta Monk Revis. She passed some years ago. But you think about someone like John Coltrane, really pushed the limits of possibility, pushed the limits of reed and saxophone, growing up in a religious community where he was trying to mimic with his saxophone the Black preaching tradition of his grandfather. And so that high pitch squeal when he's really getting into that, you think about A Love Supreme, getting to the end of that. I mean, he's taking a saxophone, pushing it to the limit, past what people say is possible, to mimic, you know, the Black preaching tradition. And then you look at someone like Thelonious Monk, great pianist himself, pushing the limits of the keyboard so much so, open up people's minds about new possibilities of what sounds like a mistake when he's playing keys is actually purposeful. to open up melodies and to push these 88 keys. I mean, for Monk, he needed probably like, you know, 200 keys to do what he really wanted to do, but he only had 88. So he would make these quote unquote mistakes as a way of opening up these new possibilities. So I definitely think you're on to something. We talk about possibilities. What would you say is either the most challenging environmental justice issue, or maybe you think there are a few challenging environmental justice issues?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot. There's a lot, and I've recently been immersed in a lot of whether the books, podcast. You know, I've been kind of maybe even over consuming resources and media around this, but I think the biggest challenge to me is our level of consumption. I think a lot of it comes down to that in our culture of consumption and obsession with stuff. And I say that not in a self-righteous sense. I say that as somebody who's battling with that myself, because I'm in this culture, you know. Even down to like having these books, I'm like, I know I could just get it on audio, but I like the book. And it's like, but bruh, if they print the book, they got to kill it, you know? And so, you know, I'm not absolving myself at all, but, you know, I think we have all of this stuff and it just, we're destroying our environment to create this stuff, to create experiences for ourselves and to try to find and literally manufacture like happiness. When the reality is, like you said in the previous segment, like we can get all of the dopamine and betamine, I don't know what the different means you said, but we can get all of the the chemical manifestations of happiness just by being, you know, in nature, you know.
That's right.
And when I find myself at greatest peace is when I'm able to actually tap into that, not when I'm in the house with all my stuff. It's when I'm on the other side of this window and I'm walking through the yard and I'm planting and I'm finding ways that, you know, even in my own little yard, that my yard is telling me like, hey, like maybe if you do this, you know, you'll help me mend this part of myself. Or when I'm in the back, you know, back in my yard, the previous owner or previous owner, there's a lot of dumping that happened. And so when I'm getting that trash up, it's like, oh yeah, you know, it's like it's when I'm nurturing that relationship is when I find the most joy personally or growing things. And I'm a co-owner operator of a CSA called Tallgrass Food Box. And we source produce from Black farmers around the state. And that process has been a revelation as well. And connecting with these farmers who have been generationally in relationship with the earth and growing food to feed our communities. And so it's like, man, this is where the joy is and the love, the action of love, you know, and growing and tending and feeding and healing and, you know, being in relationship with the natural world. And but somehow we've explicitly been sold the idea and marketed the idea that we need more stuff to be well or to be happy. That we can just download this app. If we could just, you know, buy this thing. If Instagram, and I'm a victim. And Instagram, they know me so well. They like, look, bro, don't you like these shoes? And I'm like, I do like those shoes. How'd you know? They're like, because we studied your internet activity. And so, you know, it's so, you know, I'm working through it as well, but and trying to wean myself off stuff. I also know it's not an individual thing. It's a collective. It's a collective and cultural shift that needs to happen. I think that would get us halfway there if we just stop consuming as much, you know, because that consumption is destroying if we started, you know. Yeah. So if I were to say one thing, I would say it's our cultural habits around consumption. But to that point, and I don't want to state this problem without thinking about the possibilities. I think when I learn about all of these artists that we just went through, and when I think about when I learned about the history of Black, you know, Black folks and indigenous communities and relationships that we've had with the environment, I'm reminded of, you know, what's possible. So it's not like, or even thinking about certain practices, you know, in my home or in my grandmama's home, like, and, you know, all right, I don't have to buy all of this glassware. I can just use what I got. You know, I just use the glass from the salsa container, you know, it works the same. In fact, it's more durable. And so those decisions that we make based off of perceived need to have a new thing versus using what we have and repurposing things. And, you know, some of that stuff is a part of our culture already. We just haven't connected the tendril. We haven't connected that to the idea of it being environmentalism, but it is. That's a way of being. And that's something that I found myself and my friend Monet and collaborator and comrade and commentant Monet Marshall, we talk about that often. How do we not just learn about like contemporary environmental issues and environmental injustices, but also how do we reconnect with the things that we already do that are already a part of our culture that are environmentalism? And so, yeah.
I appreciate that response that, you know, an important environmental justice issue is consumption, which made me think about consumerism and capitalism, how we've been conditioned to consume. And by and large, that is contrary to the Black, at least American experience. Because we've always pushed through the possibilities. And one of the questions they ask is recycling. And they look at recycling customs in Black communities. And by and large, according to the data or the scientists, that Black people don't recycle. But they're asking the questions wrong. It's like when they ask Black people about, do they enjoy being in nature? And they measure it by the number of trips you take to Yosemite. Well, everybody can't go to Yosemite, but people like sitting on their front porch or tending to their flowers. And that means they like nature too. But from a recycling standpoint, you know, if your grandmother was like my grandmother, you walked into her kitchen, she had a little porcelain container to the side of the stove that she stored her bacon grease. And so she cooked some bacon and put that grease in there. And then that bacon would be used to season cabbage and other things. Recycling mindset. You would take the mason or the ball jar that's used for canning in the wintertime, and you put some water and ice in there and put that in the refrigerator. And that would be your cup. This idea, as you said, reusing, repurposing mindset, which is already a part of the Black experience, perhaps not called recycling, but just called being innovative, or one might say call just being Black. What gives you hope?
You know, I think a lot of things give me hope. I think whenever I'm feeling hopeless, you know, digging into some of the work of some of the folks who I mentioned earlier gives me hope. I think even, you know, being invited to this podcast to just talk about these topics gives me hope that, you know, there's folks interested in listening, even if it's just you and me. But I'm sure your audience is much greater than that. you know, I think that gives me hope. I think the more I'm in community with folks and realize that, you know, that these conversations are possible, that gives me hope. And then even down to my own individual experience when I first kind of started like gardening and growing things, and I've kind of shifted from growing food to really growing like planting grasses. That's been my thing this year. But you know, it requires a different mode of being. It requires a certain patience. It requires accepting loss. but then there's also things that happen that you didn't expect. You know, there's possibilities in growing things. And so that, you know, really being with that process gives me hope. It just reminds me that, you know, even when it looks like something is dead, or I was talking to a friend of mine about, you know, we were talking about these palm plants and how they're hard to maintain inside, you know, but there's one that I have that, it's got some dead leaves. It was kind of on the way, what felt like was on the way out. And then, you know, but with some patience and some tending and some mending and some pruning, and then some additional care, and some light and some selective darkness, it was able to, it's come back, and it's starting to grow and have new life. And so I think, you know, really trying to be in tune with those processes, and those kind of realities, those fractal experiences, right? That those things give me hope.
We live in hope. Derek, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. It's been a rich and eye-opening conversation.
I appreciate the invitation. Thanks for having me. I look forward to connecting again soon. Hopefully, I think I'll probably see you this, maybe even tomorrow evening at the Wetland Center. There's a community meeting. So hopefully I'll see you. I saw you on the email. Hopefully I'll see you there. Look forward to connecting soon.
Absolutely. We welcome Derek Beasley, multidisciplinary artist, cultural organizer, and public servant. The Wading Deep podcast comes to you from a place we affectionately call the Bros, St. Ambrose Episcopal Church, Raleigh, North Carolina. Follow us on Facebook, YouTube, The Bros NC on Twitter, and The Bros 1868 on Instagram. I am your host, the Reverend Jermond Taylor. Gods are going to trouble the water of environmental racism, resurrecting a river of life clear as crystal. Shalom. Salam. Peace.